Welcome, everyone, to A Global Focus with this evening's guest, Chuck Zukowski, UFO and paranormal investigator with multiple field research and investigative experience. Everyone, Trish Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Tonight's guest will be Chuck Zukowski. A Global Focus airs live on the International Paranormal Radio Network with anchor station UPRN 105.7 FM New Orleans. There are several listening venues, including the latest, the PTVN and PRN networks. And thanks to Joe Montaldo, owner of the Paranormal Radio Network, for making these broadcasts possible. The expertise of our guest this evening, Chuck Zukowski, is truly considerable. Chuck's expertise covers Roswell research and field investigations, UFO sightings and landing trace evidence field investigations, animal mutilations investigations, Bigfoot field investigations, ghost investigations, and alien abduction investigations and paranormal investigations. I will try to summarize this. Please check out both the www.ufonut.com sites and HTTP, a Global Focus, or just aglobalfocus.com websites. This guest's credentials are extensive. Chuck also is a veteran amateur UFO archaeology research and field investigator, and has conducted with his team important research at the Roswell Skip and other sites. Chuck is a former certified MUFON Star Team field investigator and is an expert at witness interviewing skills and technical knowledge. Chuck is a principal IC mask design engineering consultant with his company, Zukowski Inc. He has over 25 years of graphic mixed signal IC microchip design and is a former reserve deputy sheriff with the County Sheriff's Department, Colorado, 2002 to February 2011. Chuck's education includes an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, and a certification in electronic engineering. For the past 25 years, Chuck has been researching and investigating the UFO paranormal phenomenon. Chuck approaches every investigation as a skeptic, looking for any known possibility before claiming otherwise. He also implements new and innovative field experiments from time to time to enhance his investigations, looking for new evidence. Among his investigations, Chuck has become quite fluent with the Roswell incident of 1947. He's worked closely with archaeologist Dr. Bill Dolman, UNM, on two separate UFO shows, Sci-Fi Channel special Roswell, Startling New Evidence, and NBC Sci-Fi Channel's Sci-Fi Investigates Roswell episode. Chuck has also contributed to the Sci-Fi Channel's book, The Roswell Dig Diaries, and has written a workbook, Extraterrestrial Archaeology, a field guide to UFO archaeology. Chuck was interviewed for the Peter Jennings special, Seeing is Believing, for Sci-Fi NBC's Fact or Faked, History Channel's UFO Hunters, Denver PBS, Colorado Springs, and Denver's television news stations, and numerous periodicals, including the Colorado Springs Gazette, the Denver Post, and the LA Times. Chuck has written articles for UK's UFO Matrix magazine. Chuck's website, www.ufonut.com, displays information on the UFO paranormal field and also includes personal blogs about his research, and aside here, it is a wonderful site. He also has numerous videos on YouTube under the www.ufonut heading. Chuck, I know I'm stammering, shy, pardon me.
Chuck, oh my gosh.
Well, this is just so impressive. And yeah, I'm actually abbreviating some of this. Chuck approaches his investigations with an analytical understanding, making sure to address all human known possibilities before venturing into the non-human or paranormal aspects of the sightings. This approach ensures his investigations are more plausible and skeptic-proof. Experiments have included EMF, electromagnetic field generation, VS-VCT, binary sequenced visual communication techniques, and ERE, event recreation experimentation. Chuck, what an impressive bio. There are several aspects of your research with very recent and important updates on several. Welcome to the show.
Wow, that bio, that sounds like a bunch of BS to me.
No, it's extensive, and I've never, you know, Chuck, You invited Jay-Z and I, Buddy Researcher and I, and me rather, to the Roswell site, your work on the Skip site with your team, including Sister Debbie, Matt, Trina, your archaeological team. The archaeological work you've done there is just so impressive. I can't wait to go into some of those updates there on the artifacts you found. Also, your haunting cases. Boy, Stanley Hotel, just probably the most haunted site in America, well, perhaps next to Gettysburg. You are outstanding. Now, Chuck, you've issued a new post on at your website and a press release as well on the, quote, new evidence from the 37-degree latitude theory, end quote. Here you seem to have delineated key traits in the animal mutilation phenomenon, and also you have all these interesting points to make about this 37-degree latitude and linear pattern for UFO sightings and cattle mutilations. Tell us more.
Oh, I'm going to have to make that bio shorter. I'm sorry for the people listening out there. I tell you, you know, when you get involved in ufology, you actually find out there's a lot of commonalities in the different areas of ufology. And I started off as doing crash retrieval stuff. And I'll go to that 37-degree here in a second. And what happens is, you know, you start doing different aspects of mythology, you know, it could be Bigfoot or cattle mutilations or abductions. So I just, was talking to Stan Romanek a couple of nights ago, who is a very famous abductee out of the Fort Collins area here out of Colorado. When Lone's look for a star for something that looks like it's common, and we see something in sequence. And what happened was, with all the different types of ufology research, that's why I kind of dabble in it all. We do see similarities, so like with Bigfoot, we've had UFO sightings when there's been Bigfoot sightings. Cattle mutilations, we've had, UFO sightings when, you've had, cattle mutilations, and also, earthquakes, for God's sake, you also have UFO sightings. So, what happened was, while I was just putting my PowerPoint presentation together for the Midwest UFO Conference in Missouri, Kansas City, in August, and I have all these similarities on my past cattle mutilation cases that I was touching on, and really what happened was we had an earthquake here in Colorado, and we generally don't have earthquakes. We have small ones, but we don't have good sized earthquakes. And this one happened down, near the Colorado-New Mexico border, and it was about a 5.3. And wow, that's really bizarre, And I didn't see much about it. I was still working on my presentation, and then the next day, less than 60 hours, there was another earthquake in Virginia, and it was 5.8. Magnitude. And I happened to look on my iPhone, on my app. And I have an earthquake app on there, and so I was reading the earthquake and went, oh, it says it was a 37-degree latitude. And then, I go back to Colorado and I went, well, that's 37-degree latitude. And then, when I was doing my presentation, I was making it sort of so significant that the cattle mutilations in San Jose were all in 37-degree latitude. And I couldn't wait to get home from work that night to start researching it more. And called my sister Debbie, who is the UFO State Director in Missouri. She's also an intern for the board of directors for MUFON. I started talking to her, and she said, what? Really? Hang on a second here. And she gave me a name of a town that Ken Storch had done a cattle mutilation a couple of years ago in Missouri. And I Googled it, and it did turn out to be 37 United. Then she started looking at her cases that she's had this year that include abduction, triangular sighting, sights in the sky, and they all fell within a 37-degree latitude, including, Joplin, Missouri, and Joplin was. Whoa, what do we have here? I got to look at this. And so basically, I started to pinpoint certain areas that we were getting these sightings, and I started looking at the 37-degree latitude band, if you will, across the United States. And I went to a couple of websites, National UFO Reporting Center for one, and was looking for just right from the stand, triangular. And I wanted to see if anything pops up within a 37 degree. I wasn't, you know, like I said in my blog, if you look at the United States, UFO sightings look like stars in the sky. They're just all over the place. And for years, we've kind of been looking for some type of commonality or some type of sequence or pattern or something. It's really tough to do. We're starting to see patterns. I'm starting to see patterns in, you know, in cattle mutilations that I've investigated. But, you know, you just look at the sky and you see stars. Well, we know, you know, from amateur astronomer, you know, stars, even stars have got patterns. But it takes a while to find them. You know, that's why we got, you know, Sagittarius and everything. And there's some type of... Anyway, the bottom line is, I started to look across the U.S. at the 37 degree and just look, see if I could see or find anything that had to do with lights in the sky or trying to attract. And just within a couple of days of research, I started picking up cases all across the United States. And if you go to my website look at the blog, and it's 37 degree latitude, press releases, and it says 37 degree latitude. And if you just, you know, look to read it right now, and just scroll down towards the end, you'll see a picture of the U.S., and you'll basically see a line across it of all the sightings. And bottom line is it looks like a paranormal freeway. So my theory based on that is, it seems to be that maybe these UFO sightings, or even abductions and cattle mutilations, maybe they occur linear. And even though when we look at it, it looks like, you know, it's all over the place, but if we start connecting the dots, we might get some linearity out of it. I went back and looked at, while I was looking at the 37 degree latitude, in various websites, I was also seeing some that were popping up at 38 degrees. And then I went back to my notes, and two of my other mutilations outside of San Jose, one in Rush, right, and the other one in Crested Butte, they both landed on a 38 degree latitude, and it's like a 300 mile difference between them, so that's linear. I'm thinking, coincidence or not? You know, so this is very preliminary type of a theory that I'm kind of looking at. And I'm kind of hoping that maybe, you know, we might be onto something here, that if we can find some linearity out of these sightings, we might be able to predict the areas that they're going to be occurring in, and then, you'll be better prepared for them. So, that's pretty much the gist of it right now. The earthquakes, that was something that was just an anomaly by itself. The Colorado earthquake, you know, that's in the Santa Cristi earthquake fault, I believe. And it's, I don't know exactly, right. I probably have it in here somewhere, but it runs north to south. And then the Virginia earthquake also runs north to south. So there's no connection between the two. There's no reason why one should trigger the other. None at all. But there might, but obviously there is a reason why we had two earthquakes within 16 hours of each other at that magnitude at 37 degree latitude. The Colorado earthquake is where it happened is near Delphi. Delphi borders right on the edge of the 37-36 degree latitude. And if your listeners know anything about Delphi, you know, supposedly there's a base in Delphi there, you know, in an Indian reservation, so it's really hard to get into. You have to be invited by the Native Americans of the area to get there, but even if that, you get too close, that helicopter's trying to chase you out there. You can research it, it's all over the place, and some of the stories are that there's an alien presence in the actual base in Dulce. Then, you know, then you have a Talos home. You know, I don't know if your listeners have remembered the Talos home, but you can actually, that's Talos, New Mexico. That borderlines at 36 degree latitude. We seem to think the home had, was generated by underground drilling. And, the Virginia earthquake, there's conspiracies out there already saying, well, they think it was underground nuclear testing. But what's interesting about both the earthquakes is they're very, very shallow earthquakes. You know, they're within, I think they're 3 miles depth to 6 miles. I think I have it over here somewhere. It's in the blog. But basically, that's very, very shallow mantle. So, there is information out there that says that, you know, imagery or digging mines in the past have triggered very shallow earthquakes. So we do know that tunneling can cause it. And it's fascinating. So I kind of had to throw it in there because, you know, whoever caused those earthquakes, if they're not from a natural, you know, if it's not a natural event, maybe they're the ones that are also causing or responsible for the UFO sightings, maybe the family relations. This is kind of huge. It's exciting. It's fun. And I've got a hard three months ahead of me of doing more research.
Thank you so much for that intriguing information. No, Chuck, I thought that press release and your blog article there were extremely interesting. Have you mentioned this, that you observed that Area 51 is within the 37-degree latitude? You also referenced that the 38-degree latitude, past the 37th, is respectively the location of Crested Butte and Rush. Did you just mention that? And I noticed here in the room, and it's very intriguing, they're discussing Highway 37. Now, I'm a little confused. I see a great article by Norio Hayakawa on the Internet here about Highway 37, and they mention it has to do with the San Luis Valley Tower, and I think the watchtower is at the 37th degree there. But now, there's also a Highway 37 in California. People, my researchers in the room, if you just give me something more precise as far as the latitude or the location on that. Let me see here. And, you know, that UFO watchtower in the San Luis Valley would seem to directly correspond to that theory.
Absolutely. When the UFO tower watchtower falls right in, it's on the leading edge and going into Crestone there. And that's what's interesting about the San Luis Valley. It's very unique by itself. You know, we've had Academy relations there. We've had alien entity sightings. We have Bigfoot sightings. And we've had craft sightings. And when you go back and you talk to Native Americans that live in that area, and they talk about their ancestors talking about things occurring. So we know for a fact, based on the Native American stories brought up through generations, that our military is absolutely not responsible for a lot of the things that happened in San Luis Valley. Why? Because the Europeans hadn't even settled in the United States when the Native Americans were still having experiences in that valley. And if they did, it was at that point where, you know, when we had a cavalry, you know, maybe, I think Colorado Springs, Colorado had one of the first cavalries out this far, so you know, that could be the case, but obviously nothing with the technology, causing what the Native Americans were seeing in that area. And we're also talking about shapeshifters.
Yes.
The Native Americans, you know, we call them shapeshifters, they call them religious real blank. Where some of the spirits will shape from a wolf, you know, to human. I apologize for Native Americans listening to that. They just drew a blank on what they refer to it. But that's been going on there too. Also, we see that now. I don't know if you are familiar with the Indigo Children.
Yes.
Well, we seem to think that there's a place out there near the San Luis Valley that the military had scooped up children from time to time. And they're basically the Indigo Children. These are children that have unique capabilities, let's say. And we do know that we've had a couple of shamans come out of that area as well. It's really interesting, unique by itself, and it's 37-degree latitude, but I think it's pretty much the hot spot, the mother spot, at least here in Colorado, for, you know, that type of uniqueness, I guess. No other place in Colorado, you know, has that much going on. It's pretty cool.
Yes, it is. And, you know, just two quick points here. Number one, and I'd love to have him as a guest on a panel with you, Chuck, in the coming month or two. Steve Nance was our guest last week, and he was discussing a very intriguing Colorado case. And I was noting it wasn't on the at the 37th degree, but it was close. And of course, even further up in Colorado, there are reported ongoing sightings. Now, also, just a comment here is a correction. On that Highway 37, I misread the question. Our researcher, Sandman, was referenced to the fact highways and the 37-degree latitude theory. I think he finds that very interesting. And here's a great question coming in from our Wisconsin ICAR director, Bill or Tal. Where is it? Oh, it's right here. It was a very good question. Sorry, here it is. Here's the question for you, Chuck, from Bill. Chuck, are there other types of sightings, cryptids, Bigfoot, etc., hauntings on this 37-38th degree latitude?
Well, that's a good question, and yes, there is, at least I know, in the Colorado area. I'll be researching, basically what I'll be doing in the next few months is trying to find out cattle mutilation cases and try to see if they fall within that, and then also some other things too. But absolutely, Joe Fex, I believe you have met Joe Fex, haven't you, Patrice?
But I'm dying to hear your very intriguing investigation with Joe Fex. Was it Bailey County?
Yeah, he was Bailey Bigfoot. But Joe and I actually investigated two separate Bigfoot sightings a couple years apart in the San Luis Valley, one at the Watchtower, which was amazing, and one probably around 30 miles east of the Watchtower, where the mountains are. And if you talk to the Native Americans in that area, they had talked about their ancestors saying that there was an albino, Sasquatch, in that area too. So we do know that there's, there is a Bigfoot sighting. Now, ghosts, absolutely. Anytime I go down there, I'm investigating some UFO sightings. And I'll tell you what, that's such a great, you have a couple of seconds, I'll tell you a real quick story, all right, and it touches on the ghost. Now, you know my sister Debbie, obviously, because I think the issue is on your show.
Yes.
She's very sensitive, and sometimes she can pick up on apparitions. I can't, I'm very analytical. I must have that firewall, that Windows 7 firewall. built into me. But we were, this is the honest truth, we were at Zapata Falls overlooking the sand dunes. And Zapata Falls is in between Blanca Peak and the sand dunes. And we're elevated up, and we're looking down at the sand dunes. I'm in my Jeep. I have a night vision camera pointed at the sand dunes. We had reports that there was a sighting of some lights occurring at the sand dunes. We happened to be there, and so we decided to spend a couple hours, until 2:30 in the morning, see if we could pick up on anything. And I had dozed slightly while my camera was going, because it was cold and the Jeep was running. And Debbie looked over to the right, and she saw an apparition looking at her through the door of my Jeep. And she said it looked just like a lumberjack. And, because we were up in the woods where there's trees. And then she shook her head up again, and stood there, and then it kind of went away. And then she looked over my side, and there was a guy standing there looking at me, very puzzled, looked like, what are these guys doing here? And she said the best way I could describe him was he looked like Drew Carey. He was kind of short haired, dark blue glasses, and he was wearing like a checkered shirt. And we kind of were like, the interesting thing was, is when we went up there, we had discussed possible alien sightings, possible mountain lion and bear sightings, and possible UFO sightings. We never, ever, ever considered, ghosts, for gosh sakes. And so I do want to go back up to that same location and actually do that. They don't have to do an outside ghost investigation because it's very hard to pick up on EVPs and other things, but you're not going to pick up something on the EMF. That's been something I've been wanting to do since that happened. So, and we experienced it firsthand, but that's a very good question.
Indeed it is. And wait one second here. I'm just bouncing someone from our room who made an inappropriate about the ufology study generally. And he is.
So, that's okay. Not a problem. We'll take inappropriate comments all the time.
No, We have some interesting, further interesting questions coming in. The majority of people in our room are very cordial visitors, intelligent visitors. This person was not. And also several researchers and also experiencers. And it's really a joy to see them interact with the discussion, and they ask excellent questions. Now, let me see here. Here's a further one that I thought was very, very intriguing, and it was from... before that, my question actually segues into our researcher Mark, or Nora's boy's question. That was, Chuck, do you perceive this 37-degree latitude linear pattern as having a relationship to the series of ley lines in our country and the planet? And here we have Mark, who has done excellent work, historical and archaeological work, around the country, including Ohio. He's mentioning here that the Serpent Mound in Ohio seems right on the 39th degree latitude. Are other earthworks in Ohio related to Tude? If so, why are they related to ley lines?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I tell you what, it was Tuesday night. I was in Denver, and I was talking with Rick Nelson, who's a good friend of mine. He's a paranormal researcher out there in the Denver area. I lectured at one of his meetings a couple months ago. Actually, it's last month, too. And the thing was, he's researching the ley lines and the mounds. And he's going to be giving me some information on that so I can start correlating it to see, if we see some type of significance between the two, or if they fall within the service 37 degrees. He does believe, though, that he's seen some correlation in his research with ley lines of falling in the San Luis Valley. And something that he brought up to me is sometimes he's starting to see a little bit of a correlation in longitude, too. But, I'll tackle that after I look more at the latitude stuff. So that's a really good question. And yes, we are looking at that right now. The problem is what I do is my compadres, my peers, the ones that I know that are a little bit better in the research in certain areas, I go to them and have them help me. I did that with Joe Sext, initially with Bigfoot investigations and with Nelson, with the ley lines and stuff. So, I can never claim that I'm an expertise in all this stuff. What I try to do is I try to bring the information together and then present it out to the public. And so there's a lot of research involved in between websites and books that are written, but basically between researchers that are actively, which is better than books because they're usually 1 or 2 years out of date at least. But when you have a researcher, another researcher that is actively looking at it, then you're getting real-time information, and that's what we're doing right now. But yeah, there is a little bit of correlation.
Yes, indeed. Fascinating response there. Thank you, Chuck. And just to one of our other room researchers, Hi Cop, he always has interesting comments to make. Note that Route or Highway 37 was an error on my part. Cop, I had misread the question or did not properly interpret it. But this is about the 37th degree latitude. You'll check at www.ufonut.com to both an excellent article and a press release. And before we have any other questions, I just want to reference here something. Chuck, I really appreciate your sentiments on creating the www.ufonut.com website. The public needs this information, and if one has to smile at some of the scorn directed to the ufologist's role in studying, analyzing, and relaying this information, as you said, really, it's an adventure. Don't mind the scorn.
No, it's an adventure. A lot of people get confused when I say UFO net. They think it's UFO net, like a fishing net. But it's UFO net like a walnut. And the reason what happened was years ago when I first started getting involved into actively getting involved, I do a lot of UFO research on my own. I was a couch researcher, a sofa researcher, sofa investigator, and decided to get off my butt and get out there and start doing it real time. So it was only a few that could actually get out there that hike the hike and walk the walk and get out there and walk for miles and do this stuff and look for it. And people were calling me nuts, just saying, well, you're just a nut. And I thought, oh, and the most of them, you're a phone nut. I'm like, I kind of like that. And so that kind of keeps me honest, you know, because there are UFO nuts out there. There are some really, I don't want to say some people that are really over the line because, you know, they let the concept get, you know, consume them to the point where they can't, you know, they can't differentiate between reality and what's not reality. Then we've got the skeptics and debunkers out there that call us, like you had a skeptic or debunker earlier. And what I do is, like, with the skeptics, I kind of welcome some of the skeptic remarks on my website because my wife is skeptic, and that keeps me honest. That keeps me working harder to get the material out there rather than just saying, oh, I think 37. No, I have to research, and I got to show it. I got to say, look, this is my stuff, and I do have reference material that backs it up, and anybody can back it up by looking at, you know, going to the National UFO Reporting Center and spending a couple of days doing what I did, you know. So you have to have, every now and then, you have to have the skeptics pop up and say, you know, yeah, they could call you on the bluff. When I was lecturing with Kansas City, we had two skeptics, or actually debunkers there, before Debbie and I went out to lecture, and we were just back and forth, you know, in this conference room, before we went out to lecture, and the debunkers were quoting Alchemist Razor, which basically means, you know, the simplest thing is the simplest explanation. Simplest explanation is always what's right. Well, actually, that's not even the right theory, but the bottom line is I gave him such a good argument of the material that we were presenting that when we were lecturing, they wouldn't even come in into the lecture room to even debate me, you know, during the Q&A. And that's what I said, you try to put as much information out there as you can and you try to make it skeptic proof as much as you can. Sometimes, unfortunately, it takes a little bit longer to get the information out because there's initial research you got to do before you put it out.
You are a superb researcher, and you know, I so like that sentiment about the name of the website because I had two wonderful parents who very much appreciate research in all its forms and the different subject matters, of course, that life is a learning experience. But I know I've had present family members and also even a friend in D.C. Just kind of think it hysterical that I'm in this particular field. But to me, it is one of the most intriguing and important fields of study now at this time. And wow, you have a wonderful reputation for looking at this field from a very sharply analytical point of view, with state-of-the-art methodology, equipment, and experimentation to try to verify your findings. And Chuck, you and your team's archaeological work at Roswell, including the Skip site, yielded important results. You have discovered fascinating artifacts there, and boy, in your presentations, media interviews, and blog articles, you've highlighted the importance of the study and discussion of the Roswell matter. Chuck, what are the latest developments on that research?
Well, what? I'm sorry, I was like, really? Well, that sounds pretty cool. Who is that guy?
Well, no, first of all, on that strip dig, you decided in 2002 that a strip dig for precise archaeological exploration was needed at Roswell. That yielded some important results, including that interesting metallic artifact that seems to correspond in some ways to the, to that material that Colonel Jesse Marcel used as a child.
And luckily, which is even cooler, was, you know, we actually got to talk to, you know, our Jesse Marcel Jr. And showed him the information we had. And I was able to show a little bit more detailed pictures than I could put on the website because, I mean, they're not detailed pictures. You have to crop them from the website. You just don't have enough room. But he was basically saying, yeah, you know, that's like what I have. You know, it's like what I saw. What's interesting is we found a few new artifacts back in 2002. We went back in 2006. In between there, we were 3, 4, 5, and 7, and 8. But the piece we found back in 2002 actually resembled one of the pieces that Jesse Marcel Jr. had talked about. And that's why we decided to roll on that. And the next year I would, this was, when you find material, during a professional archaeology dig, and I mean professional because, you have Dr. Bill Dillon, the guy's archaeology team, they're being funded by the University of New Mexico. This is modern day archaeology. You can't get any better than this. This is it. But any material you find on BLM land is owned by that state. And so I had to borrow the piece from, the University of New Mexico archive site before it was actually curated into a museum. But so I was able to get all the piece for about 30 days or so, and I was able to run two electron scanning microscope analyses of it. So I funded it all myself, and so there's a limitation to what I can do because it's based on my pocketbook. Electron scanning microscope analysis is only about $300 a pop. So I did two of them. The reason I did two of them because I did the first one, and then the engineer technician told me, within 2 weeks we're going to be getting a new updated software, and this machine's over $1.5 million just for the machine, and the software is almost as much. And I thought, well, okay, if I got the same results with two different versions of software, then I know I've got something that's kind of unique. So that's why I opted to have it done again. But it's the same machine, two different softwares. And I picked it up, it was aluminum silicon, basically, is what we're picking up from both times. The International Museum, when I brought that to attention, they said, no, you're wrong. It's a piece of duct tape, backing of a piece of duct tape, which is just ludicrous. What it is they just didn't want to deal with it. And so I took the ball and rolled with it on my own. And because the phone guys, if you don't want to walk the walk, you just talk the talk, and that's up to you guys. But, I'm gonna try and walk the walk with this stuff. We found it, and we're gonna go further with the research, with the lab analysis. So we got that. And I guided it back to the University of Mexico, and then we carried it into the National Museum, the University of Mexico. And so they did a press release with Debbie a couple of years back in Roswell, and it was all over the place, all over the news down there, at least on this side of the U.S. So we found something very unique there. It's not indigenous to the area. And for God's sakes, I got a 30 at that time, Dr. Bill Gomez, 30-year PhD, minor in geology, and he's saying, this is really unique. Okay, we found this. This is very unique. This needs some further attention. Then we got the guys over at the UFO Museum just down the street saying, well, it's duct tape. Who do you listen to? The professional? Whose job? Or just somebody who doesn't want to deal with it? And that's a problem we were having there in Roswell, so that's why we kind of pushed on with this without their support. So we asked for funding from somebody, or could someone pick up the ball and help us out here? At the time, I was involved in the START team as one of the START team investigators to move from. And in the beginning of the following year, last year, we got a call from Bigelow Aerospace. And they asked, we'd like to take a crack at it and see if and see what it is. And so it took a couple month process to get the artifact to that point. We had to write a proposal. They had to write a proposal. The proposal had to be submitted to, to board of directors. They need those amount. They had to approve the proposal. My only consideration was not to give a whole artifact to Bigelow, just cut a piece off and give them a piece. They need to retain the good part of the artifact for further analysis because artifacts disappear. Well, I'm so happy I did that because, when Bigelow Aerospace got a hold of the artifact, they got it in November. It wasn't until March. It didn't take that long to do lab analysis once you have a piece, But I don't know how Bigelow Aerospace works. I mean, they're a pretty big company. There's a lot of channels, a lot of departments. Maybe it took some time to get to the lab that they have doing it. Anyway. So pushing email after email after email, we got a preliminary result back saying that material provided is, I'll just read this because it's also on my website. So the other thing too, I take this stuff and I just dump it on a website. Anybody can read this, okay? It's, I don't hide anything. And other investigators ask me, well, what's the real stuff? I put it out there for everybody to read. Why? Because when I was an investigator, that's what I wanted, right? So that's what I try to do now. And so I actually put it on there. You can see the graph that they sent me. It says the material provided is a dark gray polymer that contains small amounts of several elements that are commonly used as colorants, iron, zinc, calcium, titanium. But it says we were not able to identify any mass-produced polymer that matches the sample, which means, okay, it's not common. So there goes the trash bag, you know, scenario that the UFO Museum in Roswell was saying because they didn't want to deal with it. But they add also, but the number of colors to compare to the UMass. Well, of course, you look at the most common and across the board of all the different materials that we're using today that's easy to get to, you're right. It doesn't match any of that. But there's other samples out there, too, that are very, very unique, and it's very unique to certain industries. It's a rockets, so let's say military or whatever. And so they basically said, you know, it doesn't contain any elements that wouldn't be expected in standard polymer. And I asked them, I said, well, what about the titanium and the aluminum? I'm not saying the aluminum silicon, there's a little bit of titanium in there too. And he said, well, the testing that they did on it, they called it an X-ray fluorescence, it's a silicon drift detector. It doesn't detect hard metals. It tries to detect the elements up to hard metals. The electrostatic microscope, that detected the hard metals. And so they didn't pick up any metallic stuff because they never tested for it. And so the next step was isotope analysis. And then I started to go. And that was March. And they're not returning my emails. And I emailed them again. I emailed them every other week. And so now, next week, since I decided that if I don't hear again, I'm just going to have to just call. And I'm just going to have, well, I've already called and left messages, but now I'm going to have to try and figure out another way of calling and figure out who I can get a hold of that will try and figure out what the heck's going on with this side effect. Now, by law, they have to, and if you're listening out there, by law, you, Digital Aerospace, have to give the full lab results to the Maxwell Museum in New Mexico. It is not your piece, okay? It's a BLM piece. You cannot hold on to it forever. You know, eventually the BLM is going to say, we want our analysis. You borrowed it from us. So you did. It's not theirs to keep. And for some reason, they won't talk to us. So did they do an isotope analysis on it? And it found something unique. Did they ruin it? did they destroy it? Were they afraid? You know, I can tell you that one of the reasons why I stopped becoming a STAR team member after that was because of the problem I'm having with Bigelow. Because I have right now, if you read any of the issues that's going on with MUFON, a lot of it points to Bigelow funding the STAR team, this research, and how Bigelow was overstepping the bounds and contacting the right witnesses before MUFON investigators could get them. I know that's true for a fact because I actually talked to someone that got contacted by Bigelow before a STAR team member could contact them, so I know that's true. I personally know that's true. So Bigelow's been a big problem, and there's a lot of issues with hiding information, and it may not be MUFON hiding information, it may be the outside entity Bigelow or somebody hiding information from MUFON. You know, I like to give MUFON the benefit of the doubt because, you know, my sister's going to be on the board of directors, so I have to be careful what I say. Anyway, there you are, you know, we got something unique, we're pretty excited about it. We had a gentleman, Frank, who actually was on the board, at the UFO Museum, lecturing with investigators there. I met him last year after my lecture, and he showed me some material that he found at our dig site. He was able to find our, geologist instructor there in New Mexico, in Roswell. And he found some material right near the places where we dug, and he showed me the material, and he had analysis done, and his analysis matched my analysis, so it's pretty cool. So we do have a couple of different artifacts now that we're seeing, commonalities, so we're on the right track. But, you know, I tell you what, this is one of the things we have to think about as being ufologists. When when you confront something like this and there's so many higher ups, that you know what, that's how you get. And that's how you get. You know, that's pretty much it. You know, there's so many higher up that can just shut the door on you, and that door is, you know, you cannot open. You know, and so it's so easy to do if you try to find another door.
Absolutely. You know, I think these results are extremely intriguing. Also, I think that confirmation from a similar sample found in the area, too, is very intriguing. And, boy, I must say your discussion of these results as the analysis of the sample is considered a very interesting topic here in the room, and I just want to make sure we have a composer and an astronomer, Ian SP, in the room. And his question was, what became of the material, and was any analysis made, and if so, what was determined? And you've certainly fully answered that question. And thank you, though, for your question, Ian. Well, you know, Chuck, you found other artifacts at the Roswell site. I hope so very much that you'll be returning this year to do further digs there.
Well, the thing with that is it's all based on funding. Now, I am working on a project right now with a couple of individuals that we're trying to get funding to be able to do a couple of things. When you do an archaeology dig in Roswell, in that magnitude, it was about $25,000 to $30,000 to do. So it's a little tough to do.
Yes.
It's not that easy, funding-wise. So, and it's a big deal, too. Not only do you have to, you have to get the permits, you have to get an authorized archaeologist to be able to do the work there also. I mean, there's a lot of things you have to do, so there's a lot of pre-planning. You just can't go down and dig. So we have to be really careful about what we do. The other issue is getting in the right time frame, you know, in between monsoon seasons, which is kind of difficult too. So I do know that the Sci-Fi Channel was there, I believe, in November of last year. They did a dig somewhere else for an upcoming show. I wasn't included in that, and one of the reasons why is because we kind of broke ties with the UFO Museum, because they wouldn't help us with the artifact. They pretty much basically, it's nothing get lost, leave us alone, the old, don't bother me, kid, So we kind of broke ties with him doing it on our own. They got some fun to the Sci-Fi Channel to do a separate date. Not too sure what that gig is. I don't think it's at the actual skip site. I think it's another place, but it's for a new special, I guess, coming up at some point. So there is work still going on there. It's just that we need sponsors to help us do it.
Absolutely, and you have spent, and your sister have spent so much of your own personal funds doing your investigative work. Highly commendable, and I think you're just tremendous. You really accomplished a great deal for this field. And now, let's see, we're about to go into about an 8-minute break. After that, I would very much like to go back to the topic of cattle mutilation. We have an interesting question in the room, and let me see here. Are we going to be starting our break?
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that I just got a camera in the mail from Amazon yesterday. My wife doesn't know about it. Another infrared camera. So, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of money involved in this.
Yes, there is, and you and your sister Debbie have done such tremendous work in ufology, paranormal field, and of course, Debbie is state director for MUFON in Missouri. She is on the interim board of directors now for MUFON itself. She will be a permanent director, and boy, you people have just also. She started the dive team, and your work in the field has just been exemplary. Your findings on Bigfoot, on cattle mutilations, in the paranormal field, your After the break, we'll be going into cattle mutilations, also some of your fascinating haunting cases up here in Colorado. In fact, I actually heard the subject mentioned today at the office, believe it or not. Very intriguing. Anyway, guys, we'll be back in about within about 8 to 10 minutes' time. Chuck, please stand by. And, boy, am I really appreciating this discussion. I hope I'm not rambling because this information is fascinating. We'll be back in 10 minutes, everyone.
Great, thank you.
Welcome back to the second hour of A Global Focus with this evening's guest, Chuck Ski, UFO and paranormal investigator with multiple field research and investigative experience. And paranormal investigator with multiple field experience in the ufology and paranormal various subjects. Now, interesting questions coming into the room. Chuck, right now I'd like to turn to one of the many subjects on your blog site, your website. It's a great one, www.ufonut.com, U-F-O-N-U-T.com. Right now, could we turn again to the postings on the cattle mutilation phenomenon, including the recent cattle mutilation in the Trinidad, Colorado area, I believe August, is it August 8th of this year? I'm hoping I have the correct year.
Yeah, 8-8. Uh-huh. And, will we talk about it?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, before I do that, I just want to segue immediately into that from a question here. One of our fine researchers here, Sam, just wondering, he has heard that there have been reports that sometimes the cattle mutilations might be part of a sort of an insurance scam, but, you know, I don't think that definitely is the case with all the evidence. If you mentioned to us some of the evidence, the photographic, the analysis work, but it's a good question, Sam, and it's always good to have that, you know, key analytical mind going, and says Chuck.
Oh, absolutely. That's a very, very good question. And really, the questions like that, don't be afraid to ask, because I'm not afraid to ask. When I go talk to the ranchers, the first thing I ask is this cow insured? Now, out of I've done 12 cases within the 2.5 years, there was only one case where the cow was kind of insured, and that was the case, the Garen case, and he's a corporation. Okay, so we had multiple animals. They had a ranch manager there. The ranch manager found, the animal mutilated. And I believe the insurance on that particular animal had to do with flooding or something. But I'll tell you, 99% of the ranchers out there in San Luis Valley, they can't afford the insurance. There's no insurance on it. Really. So they're just out. They're just out the money. That's the bottom line. They're just out the money. Rancher Sanchez, when I investigated his calf mutilation, he's the one that lost four calves within about a four and a half, five-week period. He was so distraught that he lost four calves in a row that he immediately, the next day after I investigated the fourth calf, he took the remaining calf and he sold them at auction because, you know, he was out of money. Now, calves, they're only worth a couple of $100 to start off with, but as they get older and you invest more in feed and medication, if that's the case, majority of these ranchers out there, their cows are free grazers. So, as the animal gets older, obviously, then it's worth more to them, especially if it's a bull, especially if it's a bred animal. But it's a very good question, and the answer is no, they're not insured. So the ranchers are just out of pocket, and they're distraught over it.
Thanks for that response, Chuck, and thanks for that very good question, Sandman. Now, Chuck, you know, reading these details, you had noted that with rancher Miller of Trinidad, Colorado, that you had investigated a case of one of his previously mutilated herd in 2009. You noted that three separate cow mutilations had occurred at his ranch. Certainly, these mutilations represent a traumatic event, but also a serious financial loss as well.
Oh, absolutely. Now, Rancher Miller is, I love the guy. He's such a down-home cowboy. He really is. You know, I'm guessing he's kind of late 60s or so, but down-home, maybe mid, let's say late 60s in case he's listening. Okay, let's say he's 50. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this guy, the rancher owns life, and one of the, you know, questions I get is, how do I know it's a mutilation case? I don't really, just, you know, basically it's based on, you know, some previous research, but when you actually, you know, you go and look and you look at the animal based on previous research, and then you start putting the pieces together. But the key is that the key, the smoking gun of all this is the rancher himself. It's when the rancher tells you, I don't know what happened to my animal. Now these are ranchers, you know, 60 years ranching experience. Okay, Spencer's third generation rancher, still lives in the house he was born in. So I can guarantee you that if he doesn't know how his animal died, he doesn't know how his animal died. They can clearly tell when there's a predator. And something else you have to understand too from people out there that may want to ask, okay, what about a bear? What about a mountain lion? Yeah, they are very aware of that. And ranchers communicate. It's a very close-knit society in that area. They communicate with each other to protect each other's animals. If a predator comes on board, they let everybody know. They'll set up traps. They'll do whatever they need. Or if it's a virus or something going on that can affect your animals, they're very, very in tune. Communication is very, very good here within the rancher community. Unlike a lot of the corporations where the left hand doesn't talk to the right hand, that's not the case. There's a lot of handshaking there. The issue with predators, though, is predators, because we call this predator scavenger, scavenger eats what a predator kills. A predator would be a mountain lion, your bear, wolf.
Yes.
Okay. Coyotes are scavengers, birds. Okay. The bottom line is you look for any type of evidence of what I call takedown evidence. I've had 8 years in a law enforcement experience. I've seen murders, and there's evidence. And that's what you look for. You look for evidence of an animal attack. That's the first thing you look for. I walk up, I don't touch the animal, you don't know how it died. But you kind of look around, and you say, okay, how did that die? And you look for any type of evidence, meaning scuff marks or claw marks or bite marks. That's the first thing you look for. With Rancher Miller, you know, he had a previous mutilation case years ago, before I did his 2009 one, and then he called me up in August. He goes, Chuck, we had another. I go, damn. And he says, this is a couple days before I'm going to hop on my Harley and go to Sturgis. And he called me in the morning, and this is, Jesus, this is why I'm a consultant, okay? And this is why I'm not sorry. Because I'm a consultant, I contract the companies, and I tell them, okay, I gotta go, and I just leave. But you see, I have to not make up the time. If I don't make up the time, I don't get paid. You know, I get paid hourly, so I just pay forfeit. It's not salary. So I have to come back later, I have to put in the extra hours to get my job done. You know, they're my customers, so I have to make sure I get that project done on time. So, but it gives me a little bit of flexibility that when Rancher Miller called me in the morning, I said, I'll be there today at 2:30. And I ran home at 11 o'clock, I grabbed my stuff, I put it in the back of the truck, and off I went, you know, two and a half hours to where he's over on the other side of tree then, you know, from Colorado Springs. So it's a little bit of a distance. Interestingly about Miller, so now he got hit again. I did find out there was a mention case while I was down there, it happened a week before, about 4 miles away from Miller. Now, that happened back in 2009, but it wasn't a cow mutilation. It was a neighbor's puppy dog. Their dog, you know, a borderline collie, I think, or border collie, not borderline, border collie, I think is what they call them. All four of the paws were cut off.
It was just
plain cut off. There was no blood anywhere. And the animals were saying, and they thought, oh my God, it was something. And now, first thing people think is satanic. And that's true, but But I guess the first thing I asked, too, is, you know, do you have any people practicing witchcraft here? I mean, so I know that San Luis Valley is very magical by itself. But I will tell you this, that in the state of Colorado, that by law, that if you find someone screwing with your animal, you can shoot them. All right, so they are taking a big risk going over these guys' ranches. And they will shoot. They'll shoot first and ask questions later. I guarantee it. Because, you know, and there's actually laws against it anyway. There's misdemeanor laws, but after you're caught a couple of times, it becomes a felony when you start, you know, killing animals. So, it's a very big deal, especially out here in Colorado. A poor rancher, you know, you got hit again. And this particular animal, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Absolutely, and you know, you've made some very good points too at your site, and of course you have performed wonderful work on another area as a deputy sheriff there for the El Paso County, and you note that at your blog site that there are other jurisdictions in the nation that really take this very, very seriously. For example, quote, April 7th, 1993, the Fife, F-Y-F-F-E, Police Department, Fife, Alabama, released a press conference about 30 animals which had been discovered dead in pastures with various internal and external organs missing, end quote. And also, quote, March 28th, 1977, the state of Florida formed a task force to investigate mysterious wounds found on cattle in Brevard, Seminole, Lake, and St. Lucie counties, end quote. So it's a very serious subject matter. It would represent both a traumatic and great financial loss to the ranchers as well. And also, now, Chuck, I hope you won't find this annoying. I have I know a brilliant researcher who has this question regarding the cattle mutilation phenomenon. He's wondering if, now, for example, you follow a very precise and extensive protocol when you deal with one of these cattle mutilation cases. And my friend, the researcher, is wondering, have any of the vets, any of the veterinarians found incisions in the cow's major arteries so that if the cows were subject to a vacuum environment, their blood would immediately vaporize under the extreme pressure and the vaporized blood would outgas? That's his question.
That's a really, really good question. No, not at this time, but the reason why it's no at this time is because the vets in that area, any vets that have done any type of necropsy on an animal was probably a field necropsy. And you do a field necropsy, and you don't do it under laboratory conditions, there's a tremendous amount of evidence that could be there that's completely lost because you're cutting a cow up in a field, basically. And then the vets will not look for that. Okay, it takes questions like from your other researcher to point out certain things for them to look at. Earlier this year, I got to sit in with a horse necropsy at the Colorado State University Veterinary Lab. I'm in close contact with the lab there on every cattle mutilation case I do. And the reason I do that is I call them up and say, I'm going on a mutilation case. I've been on that lab at least three times, twice. I've lectured there on cattle mutilations to the new trainees coming in and the doctors there. And so they're excited, they want to get something, but they have criteria themselves. They're the ones that tell me, okay, they are so excited about this, but they have criteria. This is where other investigators miss the boat completely. Well, take a sample, take dirt, do this, do that. Really? And who am I going to give it to? And what are they going to do with it? The bottom line is, and this is an engineer talking, I've been involved in this, we have labs. You have to know what your lab can do. You know, our lab, obviously, you know, we check the test chips, the microchips that we do. But, so you have to contact the labs first, and you have to find out what the lab is capable of doing and what do they want that will best justify the money you invest, you know, and the time and the effort to this. And that's what I did with the Colorado State University. And they were so into that, not only will they give me a deal, what they want, but basically, they're not that expensive, so they're very easy. But, But they have a very, very expensive lab there at this university. They train all the vets in this part of the U.S. they're very, very highly qualified and highly noted. That's why I picked this particular lab. Unfortunately, it's on the other side of Colorado. That means I would have to transport an animal roughly 5 hours from point A to point B to bring the family inside to Fort Collins. But I know exactly what they do. They even brought me in. We did a necropsy. And then all the blood, like you're saying, one of the things I always talked about was the loss of blood. And you're right, you know, it would be good to look at the arteries. And they would look at the artery. I guarantee that, because what happened was that in the necropsy I did earlier this year, I got the, you know, we cut the, it was a large horse. We cut the horse open, and they gave me the heart. And they taught me how to properly, you know, cut into the heart and open up the left the left side of the heart. There, it proves I'm not a doctor. Ventricle, thank you. And what to look for is it's blood loss. Now, in a normal animal, it's really easy. If you cut the heart open, you'll be able to see the blood coagulates like a jelly. You know, I hate to say it, it's like strawberry jelly, with cheap jelly with no strawberries in it, and it was dark, so it means like it's strawberry grape. But it tells you that there was blood in the heart at the time of the animal's death. Now, the reason why I got that to the attention is because when we do bring in a cow for a complete necropsy, that's what it is we look for the pellet in the heart, and we're going to see if there's any coagulated blood. If there's not, it tells us that, you know, the heart will be probably collapsed anyway. That means the animal's bled out. That could be the main thing. Then, from there, we will look into how it was bled out. And that's a very good point about looking for incisions, and I'm gonna note that right now. So, you know, next time I talk to him, well, I'll just add it to my criteria. That's one of the things they can look for is like razor-like or some type of incision of the artery that would bleed it out and vaporize it or whatever. The main thing is, you know, the lack of blood there. Yeah, very, very good question. Now, as for labs, now we have to go by the labs criteria. The lab to do a proper necropsy on an animal and get the results I'm looking for. Okay, they have to have an animal dead within no longer than 30 hours, 32 hours, depending on, that period of time can decrease a bit and increase a bit, depending on the temperature. Okay, if it's colder outside, okay, we can go a little bit longer because, it hasn't been deteriorating that much. If it's hotter outside, real hot, it's less time. So what I do is I send high-definition pictures of the animal right to them, and they're looking at this, and they tell me, bag it or not. You know, this last one, the Miller case, I took samples, sent high-definition samples to him at the cow, and I said, you know, don't bother, it's a little too far gone. You'll probably get the same results you got last time with your previous ones. But they said, hang on to them anyway, and I do. I have the samples in formaldehyde, so they'll, you know, they'll last for a little while. Formaldehyde's hard to get, too. But I got your samples. Now, I hate to extend this question because it hits these other, you know, questions after, but this particular one, if you go to the website and you look at, you know, Cattle Mutilation Trinidad, Colorado, 8/8/2011. The very first picture you'll see is the animal laying in a field. It's obvious as hell. You look at it, there is a round depression that the animal is laying in. The depression is roughly, you know, 18 feet in diameter. You see that. So what I did was I took soil samples. I took the soil sample inside the circle, and I took the soil sample about 50 yards away outside the circle based on another lab, soil analysis lab, recommendations on how to take soil samples based on what their lab can do. I shipped that off. I'm waiting for analysis on that. And what I ask you to do, very, very simple. I want you to tell me if there's a difference. When your complete lab, it's about $65 to $100 per bag, and I send them two bags. You know, because I'm limited in my budget. But basically, you know, your basic analysis on soil, and then I'll look at it, or you can compare it for me and see if there's a difference. And that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a difference between the two. I'm not being specific, because at this point I don't know what direction to go into.
Thank you. That information. Yes, and that information is extremely intriguing. Now, I know we have a law enforcement researcher in the room. Boy, he's a wonderful public servant from the Northeast, cop, who's mentioning, of course, soil and air samples of the tests around the site of one of these fallen animals. Also, he's wondering, too, if these, perhaps one possibility, the cow could be killed somewhere else and dropped at the site. But I've noticed a thing as well, a great summary. Well, actually, there are several, at least two or three spots there in your blog where it references summaries of some of the traits of the cattle, or the cattle who have been victims of this cattle mutilation phenomenon. And, for example, the soil, quote, lack of evidence showing animal struggle on topsoil, lack of evidence showing predator attacks on the topsoil and on the animal, end quote. But then it gets quite graphic, and not, you know, just to mention two of the graphic entries, rather upsetting, quote, oval incisions which removed hide at the ear and eye area, tongues cut completely out deep inside the mouth, end quote, and another, quote, complete center sections of the animal missing but only occurring in cases involving calves, end quote. It's a serious phenomenon. It's a very upsetting one.
It is. Now, with the particular Miller case, and it is actually... Oh, wow, I just realized it. My two main cases. I just drew a correlation to it, and that's really interesting. The Miller calf case I did in 2009, that was the first case I saw that it definitely appeared to have been dropped because the rib cage was broken. It wasn't chewed, it was actually broken due to impact. And then now the Miller case again, his big animal, this is on the 8811, I did notice that the dirt was pushed up, ever so slightly, maybe an inch and a half, or maybe a couple centimeters, it was pushed up around the body of the animal. The animal was soft, the dirt was soft. That means the animal came down with some type of an impact. It pushed up the dirt around it, almost as if the animal was in some type of a shallow, very, very shallow, you know, grade, if you will. So, yes, this was another case where it definitely looked like it had been dropped. And I don't mean just dropped from just falling over on its side. Now, all these animals, one of the things we look for, that we can determine that it's mutilation cases, lack of struggle, and especially when it's in soft dirt, you can look at the hoofs. And I can guarantee you, I talked with the vet over at Colorado State University, and he said that the animal will struggle while it's dying. It's just not going to lay there completely still and just die. It does move. I'm sure there's an exception to every rule, but not all the cases, you know, that I've investigated are all the same. The animal just does not move. That means it was dead and in place there. Okay. One last thing, Therese. Mm-hmm. For your cop researcher out there, be very careful. I was in 8 years with Colorado State, our El Paso County Sheriff's Department for 8 years. But I was a reserve. I was a volunteer because I did microchip. That's my business. I was terminated in February of this year. Here it is, the first line. The termination is a result of you conducting paranormal and identified flying object investigations into animal mutilations and then publicly contradicting and being critical of the office, the official sheriff's office investigation in public forum. What happened was that I did an investigation of the Rush horse mutilation. The sheriff's department sent a couple of deputies out there that really didn't know what they're doing. The case report basically has two very, very short paragraphs. Very short, you know, five lines on one and eight lines on the other, that describes two horses that were mutilated and then didn't even describe the two animals that survived the mutilation with marks on them. I was interviewed by Fox News in Denver, and I said, this is a clear-cut case of animal mutilation, and then Fox News went over and talked to the representative for the sheriff's department. They said a predator did it. And when it aired, they said, you contradicted the sheriff's department, and you're a deputy, and you're fired. And I'm like, well, you guys are a-holes. and then when I researched the case further, and this is for all the cop friends out there, I pulled a case report, including the sheriff's office supplements on it. The code selection, code section, Colorado code section is 18-9-202, cruelty to us. That is the case report. cruelty to animals cannot be a violation on other animals. That's predator. Now, that's what the Sheriff's Department told the public. The Sheriff's Department told the public that a predator killed these two horses. Their own case report said it's cruelty to animals, which means possible, you know, human intervention. All right? So, no, I didn't contradict the deputies that showed up. The Sheriff's Department lied. They lied to the public, and I got terminated because either they're trying to hide it or just don't want somebody like me doing that type of work. Very interesting. Very interesting. And anyway, yeah, that's a discussion all by itself. I was on one interview just on that alone for an hour.
Very well said, Chuck. Important points are as well that you have laid your life down while performing sheriff duties and that you have performed your deputy sheriff duties on a volunteer, non-paid basis. And what else? To me, this incident perhaps suggests a possible political situation. And actually, these people do need to appreciate the full scope and aspects of the mutilation and the fact, too, that multiple field analysis and correlation and participation could perhaps get an answer on this phenomenon much more quickly than just segregating the research, segregating the methodologies. And you've just done a tremendous, I think you've just been a wonderful asset to the ranchers, a tremendous help to them.
Well, yeah, I even offered to give lectures, you know, or not really a lecture, but more like a training class to the deputies, you know, at the Sheriff's Department to teach them what we think, or what depicts, I should say, what a mutilation is compared to a predator. But even in the old, you know, narrative from one of the deputies, he put right on it that the only... He says that the horses were discovered killed and mutilated. Even the deputies there used the word mutilated, which I thought was kind of funny. And here I get terminated for doing a mutilation investigation. Yeah, very interesting. Sheriff's Department over here, Tony, does not want to be involved at all or even take this serious. Matter of fact, it's a joke to them, I guess. Especially if you talk to some of the ranchers out here that dealt with you know, Sheriff's Department in conjunction with a phenomenon like this. I'm not saying the deputies on duty that are out there every day. They're different. I'm talking about the command staff, the guys who pull the strings. Because I talk to the deputies, I've rode with the deputies on duty, and they're very, very real individuals and, you know, very sincere about it, too. All those changes, once it gets higher up into the command chain. Oh, absolutely. You know, it's a very interesting business now. In some cases, like Fife, you know, they'll turn around and they'll do press release, they'll work with the vets, they'll do that. So it's really dependent upon the, you know, the law enforcement agency and who's running it at the time. You know?
Absolutely. I'm wondering, too, if there might be an additional motivation as well, perhaps embarrassment that they've not had the answers for these ranchers who have suffered serious losses due to the mutilation events. Perhaps they have to think outside the box.
Well, absolutely, but for any law enforcement individual out there, and any good one, I'll just say that, knows that they, you know, they're not judging jury, but the they don't have answers to every situation. They have answers to some situations, but there's a lot of situations out there that it's all based on speculation. That's why you know, you hook them and you take them in and you let the jury and the judge, you know, make the decision. And that's not the case with some of them. Some of them, they feel compelled that it's like our Air Force denying that, you know, that we have UFOs flying over. They do not want to admit that they do not have complete control of the skies over the United States. It's that simple. If they just say, we don't know what those things are, then someone says, well, then that means you have no control, and that means it's a deterrence, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, yeah. You know, you know, just admit it that, you know, we're not all that we think we, and there's, you know, other things going on that, yeah, we cannot explain. You know, that's serious. You know, only thinkers really have to try and explain everything.
Very well said, Chuck. And boy, we have an intriguing question coming into the room from an individual who hosts his own program, the Chip Mine Cemetery program. It's a very intriguing program. I believe it's on the Blog Talk Network, and at times it's carried here on this network as well. Well, this is Chip's comment. He's wondering, Chuck, if any of the cattle ranchers with whom you've spoken have considered any form of electronic monitoring of these animals to see when they leave the rancher's territory.
That's really a good question. I get a lot of those questions, you know, and then also surveillance cameras and everything. First off, all that stuff is very expensive, and they really don't have. I mean, a lot of these ranchers down there are living on a shoestring as it is. They may have, the majority of these ranchers that I'm dealing with, they only have 40, 50 head of cattle and some cows. They're free-range cows, so that means they never stay in the same location. If you talk to a lot of the ranchers out there, like, I mean, where's your cows? No, they're over at Harry's place. The grass is getting a little high there, so they move them over there. So they use their herds also as lawnmowers. They, you know, the free graze, they just feed off or whatever's there, so they constantly move around. Secondly, I did try to use surveillance, motion sensing surveillance. Guess what? I got about 50 pictures of, great pictures of cows walking by. You know, electronic devices, though, that could work, but you wouldn't be able to afford every one of them, but you could probably, you know, pull one on a couple or something, and we are kind of looking into that. Now, here's the video. I'm glad you brought up electronic devices. Excuse me. Because with the Aaron case, I did find evidence of a high EMF field. Now, for all you ghost hunters out there that are listening, you know what an EMF field is. Now, where am I finding a high EMF field on a dead animal? Not only did I find a high EMF field, I found a high EMF field that was dead over the Earth's magnetic field. The Earth's magnetic field is 50 microteslas. I found 100 microteslas coming from this gaping hole in the side of this animal's head. And which tells me, okay, that means there's some type of residual in there, thinking. So what I did was I contacted the manufacturer who designed the EMF meter that I have. It's a tri-field natural EMF meter. I also use it for ghost hunting. It's a really, really good. They're about 2.5. You can find it for 2.5. They have an alarm on. I talked to the owner who actually designed the meter. It's a small company, Alpha Labs. And he says, and it appears that you might have picked up residual from electronic device. Okay? I'm thinking, wow, that's pretty cool. That means possibly there was an implant in this animal that was taken out via the cavity into the brain area. That's why I took out the side of the head. And then from, and I picked up the residual of the electronics in the muscle tissue within that period of time I was there. It was dissipated over, you know, over longer. Real quick, I have to just, and this is just, you know, news today from, and I specifically, that's what I could, you know, tell you about it. On Science Daily, I'm hooked up to Science Daily every day so I can see what's going on, and you never know, this is proton-based transistors could let machines communicate with living things. Basically, human devices from light bulbs to iPods send information to electrons. Human bodies and all other living things, on the other hand, send signals in the form working using ions or protons. Well, actually, the University of Washington is looking at creating a piece of a device that could communicate directly with living things. This is the very beginning research of an implant that we've been talking about in the decades that people have been saying, hey, you're crazy. Well, so long the time we're thinking that implants in people were probably organic because their body might reject them if they weren't organic. Well, it appears based on this Science Daily that those are organic because the organic material can communicate directly to the body. Something that now we're going, oh wow, here's a new one. And I sent that information off to a couple of friends of mine that are doing some research and abductions. So same thing with the cow, you know. So if there's a probe inside there, it may not be a probe that may be gathering information, it may be a probe that's actually controlling the animals.
That information is so timely and relevant Thanks so much, Chuck, because, of course, the biological implants are of such importance, and here there's a direct connection with the cattle mutilation aspect. Thank you. That's really intriguing. And I also have an interesting question coming in from Tal. Our Wisconsin ICAR director is a good one, too, as well. Do other herd animals, Chuck, investigate the dead calves or cows or adult cows?
Do the other herds what?
Do other herd animals investigate the dead calves or the dead cows?
Now, that's a very good question. It is a very good question. The reason why is because that was one of our questions. When we investigated the Crested Butte, we found the animal laying in an oval depression. Okay, just like the one in August 8th of this year, it was laying in an oval depression. Like, a cross circle, if you know, not really, it's just... And we're looking at it and thinking, and we're seeing hoof marks or anything, but we're thinking, well, could the other animals have circled around it? Now, I did talk to an eyewitness, and he said, well, we saw some animals near it. And they were just near it, and we thought, well, could they circle around it? Well, I don't know. Did cows circle around other dead cows? So I started talking to the ranchers themselves, and they said they had never seen that. They had never seen a cow or a herd come back and kind of walk around the animal and try and figure out what happened to the animal and kick it or whatever, whatever. I mean, like maybe an elephant would do, or definitely a dog would do, we started rethinking that, well, could we, then why is this animal laying in another depression? Then we found it again in August 8th of this year. So based on the ranchers, the answer would be, they just kind of, leave them alone. Based on what, the ranchers have told us. I can get into all these exceptions to every rule, but not at this point have we seen that or been able to record it.
Thank you, Chuck. That's very intriguing. Now, there are two questions here. One from Chip, another excellent one as well. Thanks, everyone, for these great questions. I'd also like to add mine to it. Now, Chip is Chip of Chip Mine Cemetery, great program. Ask you, Chuck, do you think that the ETs tag and study cattle as perhaps even a testing ground for the taking or the tagging of humans, And I'm wondering, Chuck, if perhaps one reason for the mutilations could be obtaining biological samples on environmental testing for radiation or toxins, or perhaps obtaining biological resources?
Okay, two good questions. They go off a little bit of a different direction. The first one, reading some other research from researchers, investigators looking at alien abduction cases, that bovine hemoglobin has shown up on some stains, and this is just based on their research. I haven't been able to pinpoint that, but their theory was possibly cattle mutilations, that certain parts of the animal, maybe DNA or something within the animal, to help with the hybrid process of aliens. Now, I personally haven't seen any of that. I haven't been able to tie it down where I can prove that this person was wearing this shirt and came back with bovine hemoglobin stains on it. This is just based on some of the stuff that I read about from other researchers. That's where I've heard the tie-in between aliens. Now, your question, Therese, was radiation. Now, every one of the cows that I investigate, I hear with the guy here kind of looking for radiation, first off. The radiation in that area is, that was a concern of mine, as I was thinking that possibly there was some nuclear testing near Alamosa that was never talked about, or at least maybe on a smaller scale, above ground stuff, and maybe that's why they were doing it. That's when, we were all thinking about that from the very beginning, but these cattle mutilation cases, horse mutilation and goats and sheep, they're appearing all over the world now. Since I've been doing this and people have been reading my website, I've been getting emails from Dominican Republic, from Canada, from the UK. We talked back and forth with a couple of investigators in the UK that were losing sheep exactly the same way we're losing cows out here in areas that type of nuclear testing at all. In England. So, to protect me and to protect my team, that's the first thing I do is look for any type of contaminants that may affect you know, team members, and really, I haven't picked up anything. My Geiger counter's old. It is calibrated, but it's old. It's one of those old silver sensors. I had one on order, a nice one, and then, the earthquake hit in Fukushima, and radiation meltdown three nuclear power plants, and now you can't find one. I have one. It's been on back order because they're buying them up as fast as, as they can make them for Japan. So I'm going to have to wait a little bit before mine comes in. But that's what I'm looking for, is very trace of evidence of radiation.
Thank you. That was very informative. Thank you for those responses, Chuck. Now, Chuck, we now turn to another expertise aspect of your research investigations, that being hauntings. Now, at your site, there are interesting articles on a few of the cases. The Stanley Hotel, one of the most haunted locations, I was told today at the office in the United States. I believe it's near Estes Park, a beautiful Rocky Mountain location. You conducted a ghost investigation there April 2nd, 2011. You used interest equipment there, including your Sony, is it HI-8 or Hi-8,
HI-8
camera?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Tri-field natural EMF meter, several pieces of equipment. Please go right ahead.
First off, for the listeners out there, why would a UFO investigator get to the paranormal? It's always been a fascination for me. But what happens is, and this is absolutely the truth, is I would get calls from people that think that they've been affected by aliens. And then I would go talk to them and interview them, and I find out it's not aliens, that they have a ghost. And so I would contact, local ghost investigators to take it from there, because that, I had dabbled a little bit with it, but, I didn't really go ahead strong with it because I really didn't have a lot of the materials, a lot of the equipment to do it. And then we started to see a correlation between abductees also having paranormal, cases. And so now I had to get more involved in doing paranormal investigation to understand the paranormal stuff. Let's not use the word paranormal, because paranormal really means anything outside the normal. It's ghost investigations, it's our spirit investigations, because paranormal could mean UFOs, Bigfoot, everything like that, too, but it's been... Somehow it's been robbed to be considered a ghost, only ghost. But, so I had to get involved more in ghost investigations to understand that. Because what we think happening right in terms of alien abductions is if an active abduction is occurring, there's a residual energy there that may attract spirits. And we're seeing that a couple cases, the most popular well known cases is the Romanac case in the Fort Collins area. And then we're seeing in other cases too. So I got started just a little bit about it, and then got heavily involved in it, and it's a lot of fun. I tell you, since I've been doing ghost investigations, I can tell you one thing. There is life after death. There's no doubt about it. And I'm very, very comfortable about it now. Before you're always that feeling, I was brought up Christian. I was thinking, you're good. But the bottom line is I've had questions, EVPs, answers to my questions, direct responses. We've seen things. We picked up high EMF, saw the shadows. We did a case by South Park in Fulton, Colorado, at the Hand Hotel. My poor son, he just got back from Iraq. Well, Colorado National Guard, he was there for a year. And he's really into ghost hunters on TV and stuff. And he heard about the investigation, so he asked me to come along. So he'd only been out a couple of weeks, right? I said, yeah, sure, get your mind off what was going on in Iraq. The poor kid. This is what happens with ghost investigations. For anybody out there that wanted to do ghost investigations, be careful. For anybody that doesn't, they know exactly what I'm talking about. You can be in charge. I'm in charge of ghost investigation. I'm running the whole thing. But not really. The ghost will tell you who's in charge. Because you bring a team in there, and there'll be one, or maybe, if you're lucky, two people in the team, that will get the answers you're looking for. That will get the responses. For some reason, they will decide who they want to talk to. Just because you're the head person doesn't mean that you're going to be in charge. That's not the case. The ghost will tell you who's in charge. And so we're doing the CDP session in the basement at a head hotel. And and basically, in the middle of the session, my son got touched by something. We saw shadows. We picked up high EMS. We got the cameras even flickered when we got the high EMS spikes. When we felt the breeze, everything was happening at exactly the right time. We had, three different types of evidence to correlate one event, so it worked out really well. But for some reason, all of us were asking questions, but when my son asked a question, the same question, he would get the response. So we did in turn. Unfortunately, he was in charge, and he had an EVP session, and things were touching him and brushing against him, and finally something touched him on the lower part of his body by his belt line. And the story goes, "Dad, it feels like a curling iron on my back." Okay, now this little kid scared the shit, right? Just got back from my rack, but he's scared. And we're standing up, and we're going through off on the EVP session for a moment, and we got our cameras on, and you could clearly see two round marks, and they went really, really dark, but you could barely see them because we were using the red. You can see marks on his back, and I felt it. It was a little warmer than the rest of his skin, and he was becoming nauseated, and he started passing out. And we stopped the EVP session. We went upstairs. We were going for 15 minutes. He was a trooper. He was just go back down and see what's going on, and we went right back down after that. And it was within a couple of minutes, it started EVP. He got started getting the same results, but he didn't get touched again. That was kind of scary because we got interaction rather than just getting an EVP, or something like that. We got some, almost a handshake. Some people say, was the entity trying to hurt you? I don't think that. I think it was just trying to touch you. I think it just has to do with the energy of the entity touching energy. It's almost like, taking your wool socks and walking on a carpet on a dry day and touching the, something metal, and you're going to get a shock. I think that's what it is. I believe it's a form of communication. And any ghost investigation I do, I'm very, very polite. I don't pull the stuff that you see on TV where we try to arouse them, but I'll never be disrespectful because, they were human at one time.
Very well said. You know, we have about 2 minutes left, and I hope so very much we'll be a soon return guest. Chuck, also just briefly, I wanted to mention that outstanding April 2010 research visit, the Outlaw and Lawmen Jail Museum in Crickle Creek, Colorado, where you were utilizing the equipment for electromagnetic field. You were using the electromagnetic field generation device. Several experiments there. You were using the I think it's the modality of the reenactment scenarios. Sounded really fascinating.
You bring science to it.
Absolutely, and this is a bit off on a tangent, but do we have one more minute, Joe? We do have an interesting question coming in from the gentleman whom I hope you will speak with on a panel, Steve or Fourth Kind. An excellent question, but it's back towards the animal mutilations. His question is, many claim that these animal mutilations are being conducted by the military. Why would they use public stock instead of using their own animal control groups? Wouldn't that be more effective?
Very, very good question. Some people believe it's military. Some people believe that it's alien. The bottom line, the military doing, if it is the military, is what you're doing is they take the animal, they do whatever they need to it, and they drop it back. And the only reason why they drop it back is to instill into the community and to put a question mark on who's actually doing it and to take the evidence away from them into an unknown, UFOs, Chupacabra, or I even heard Bigfoot. But that would be the main reason, is to instill fear into the community.
Thank you, Chuck. Thank you so much for this very informative discussion. We appreciate your time so much and your information, and thank you again for your outstanding work in this field. And thanks, everyone, for listening this evening. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Thank you very much. Anybody has any questions, just go to my website and email me, and I'll answer them.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to A Global Focus this evening with guest Chuck Sukowski. Great weekend.
UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.